Good morning. Good morning. I'm Trish Thompson. I'm the.
Can you hear me without this speaker? Without the microphone?
Use the mic. Okay. I'm Trish Thompson. I'm the Executive Vice President of the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's my great pleasure today to welcome you to the Institute. We have, I think, a very interesting agenda, and I just have a few remarks before I turn it over to our speaker by way of a tee-up. As I think everyone in this room probably knows, tensions have been dangerously rising in Lebanon since November of 2006 when the opposition forces pulled out six of their ministers from the government and launched a sit-in in downtown Beirut on December 1st. Clashes broke out at university campuses after the opposition called for a strike, and Lebanon teetered on the edge of all-out violence. Almost simultaneously, over 30 donor countries and agencies were gathered in Paris to pledge debt relief and aid to Lebanon. Lebanon subsequently received over $7.6 billion in aid to help the country recover from last summer's war and address its ruinous debt. Lebanon's debt actually exceeds about $40 billion, as I understand, a sum equal to 180% of its GDP. Meanwhile, the political deadlock has prevented the Sinoera government from implementing its economic reform packages and have made the situation worse. With that as a tee-up, please join me in welcoming Lebanese Minister of Economy and Trade, Sami Haddad. Today, he will discuss the status of economic reform in Lebanon, the challenges facing the Lebanese government, and U.S. and international assistance policies and directions in Lebanon. Minister Haddad has a long history of working with the IFC and the World Bank. In his latest post, he was Cairo-based MENA director from 2000 to 2005. He has also worked at the Beirut Central Bank and with the private sector. He has a degree from the University of Wisconsin in Madison and American University in Beirut. Welcome, Minister, and I'll turn over the podium to you.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very happy to be here with you, and thank you for your invitation. And I plan, if I go through it extensively, it will take a long time, so I'm planning to go relatively fast and stop at certain key slides and talk for about 20 or 25 minutes and then open the floor for questions and comments and anything you would like to say. The Lebanese economy is the most heavily indebted economy in the world. Our debt has reached 185% of GDP. So, our economy faces a lot of problems, but this is by far the largest, the most daunting, and it threatens to destroy the country. So we have to address it. The reasons behind this high level of indebtedness are that we have been running large budget deficits over the past years, mostly due to our civil war and other political and security issues. The lighting is not very good here. Most importantly, one can look at the balance sheet situation, but I would like to just no, that's fine with me. I don't. It's better. Okay.
How's that?
That's very good. The magnitude. 185% of GDP is scary, but when you look at, the fact that debt service, i.e., interest payment on the debt, is consuming almost 2/3 of total revenues. It's completely unsustainable. And we are having also a very significant problem in our power sector, i.e. our electricity sector. So when you add up what we pay to make up for the losses of the electricity sector and interest on the debt, it amounts to 82% of total revenues. Therefore, there is very, very little room for maneuver, and it illustrates how acute the problem is beyond the just figure of 185% of GDP. Next, please. Now, the debt has reached almost $41 billion. This debt is roughly 50% denominated in Lebanese currency and 50% denominated in foreign currencies, mostly US dollars. Most importantly, the debt is overwhelmingly domestic because most of the dollar-denominated debt is owed to Lebanese residents or Lebanese institutions, mostly the banking sector. So if we look on the right-hand side, BDL is the central bank. So between the commercial banks and the central bank, we have almost 70% of debt that's held by the banking sector. And the 19%, which is other debt to non-banks, some of it is in the hands of Lebanese residents, some in the hand of non-Lebanese residents. And this, therefore, what we know for sure is that 7% of our total debt is really external debt. And we don't owe money to foreign commercial banks. We don't owe money to Citibank or HSBC or Societe Generale. This is owed essentially to institutions like the World Bank, Islamic Development Bank, Arab Fund for Economic Development, etc. Okay. Now, obviously we need to make a huge fiscal effort to address the problem. And in order to address the problem seriously, we have to drastically, next please, we have to drastically reduce expenditures and we have to increase revenues, i.e. increase taxes. So we have put together a reform program which we presented at the Paris Donors Conference, which was held on January 25 and was very successful. The main pillars of this reform program are obviously, as I was mentioning, to address the budget deficit. But we also are very keen to spur economic growth because that will also help us to get out of the present mess we are facing. The economic growth agenda is very intimately linked to our privatization program, which I will discuss a little later. And we have in Lebanon some significant social disparities, income disparities, and some unacceptable social indicators that we are very keen to address. Next, please. So, the imbalance in our fiscal accounts is so big that no matter what we do in the short run, we need the assistance of foreign donors. So we are determined to proceed with our reform program, and we want to reduce expenditures and increase revenues, but we also need your help. Now, what are the main fiscal measures? There are essentially three main fiscal measures. One of them is to increase the value-added tax. We have successfully implemented a value-added tax. The value-added tax today stands at 10%. It's going to be increased beginning next year to 12%, and 2 years later it will be increased to 15%. The gasoline excise tax will also be gradually adjusted. Here it says beginning end 2007, which is still something we want to do. The extent of adjustment will obviously depend on the international price of oil. What happened is that in 2004, the Lebanese government took a decision which I consider to have been unfortunate for political and social reasons, and froze the gasoline prices in Lebanese currency at their then level. But in the meantime, international oil prices increased, and therefore we ended up with much less revenue. Now this link has been unfrozen, International oil prices have recently declined over the past 2 to 3 months, but I think that we have no choice but to increase gasoline prices by the end of this year, and we need to come back to at least the level of revenues that we were generating from this tax in 2004. We also intend to increase the tax on interest income. We have a tax on interest income at 5%, and this is going to be increased to 7% beginning 2008. Now, many of you will think, why are you not increasing these taxes immediately? And from a fiscal point of view, obviously, we should have increased them yesterday or last month or whatever. The reason is that the economy is pretty fragile now, and we are worried that if we implement these tax increases now, that the recessionary situation could possibly get worse. In terms of expenditures, there are a number of measures that we need to take. We have two funds that have outlived their purpose and will be closed. One is a fund to help people in the South, which was instituted many years ago, and another one is what we call the Fund for the Displaced. This was meant to compensate people who lost their homes during the Civil War that started in 75 and ended in 1990. So these two funds will be closed, and but the most important component of the reduction in expenditures come from EDL, which stands for Electricité du Liban. Electricité du Liban is a government organization that has the monopoly of producing and distributing electricity. And it's a messed up outfit, in every respect. We have technical problems, we have distribution problems. We're trying to substitute natural gas for the heavy fuels we are presently using. And to summarize, the cost to the government of the electricity sector reached $1 billion in the year 2006, which is absurd. And despite the fact that we have lost $1 billion, we have not been producing sufficient electricity, particularly outside Beirut. Many areas don't receive electricity on a regular basis from this government monopoly, and people have to resort to generators. Generators are polluting, noisy, and also the cost of electricity from these generators can reach up to 30 cents a kilowatt hour, so it's very inefficient. So we have a lot of things that we need to do to reform the electricity sector. Now, one of the pillars of the reform program is a privatization program. And the most important asset that we have for privatization, the jewel in the crown, is the telecom sector, and specifically two mobile phone companies. We are moving forward as quickly as we can with this privatization. The government has already appointed a regulatory agency, the Telecom Regulatory Authority, which will have broad jurisdiction over the sector and will act as an independent regulator. We have already appointed two investment banking advisors, who are Citibank and JP Morgan. And they have advised us that the proceeds from this privatization would amount to around $5 billion. And by law, the proceeds from this privatization will have to be used to reduce the debt. And therefore, this would be, once it is concluded, the largest financial transaction in Lebanon's history, and the one that will have the most immediate and drastic impact on debt reduction and the reduction of debt service. And the idea, obviously, is to sell to have 100% privatization of these two companies. In addition, we are working on corporatizing the fixed line organization, which is now called Ogero and will be renamed Liban Telecom. And at a later date, we will also issue a third mobile license. So, I can go on and on. What's important to note is that this privatization is a win-win transaction. Number one, many people and many countries tend to object to privatizations because they end up in increasing unemployment, job losses, etc. This privatization will not result in a single job loss. On the contrary, this privatization will create many jobs. And I will just point out the situation we are facing today. The penetration rate of mobile phones in Lebanon is one of the lowest in the region. I mean, if you look at oil producing countries, the penetration rate is sometimes over 100%. Lebanon was a pioneer in this sector around 10 years ago, and we have fallen behind for many reasons. The obvious reason is that when this technology started in the world, Lebanon, as you know, is natural for the Lebanese economy, allowed the sector to be dominated by the private sector. So we had two private mobile phone companies that were doing well, and we were ahead of others. In the meantime, we did what we should not have done, i.e. we nationalized these companies. So today, the government owns the assets, and we have two private companies that manage these assets. And, I mean, you don't have to be a very smart economist to appreciate that once this privatization takes place, there will be significant investment, there is latent demand, the penetration rate could easily double from 25% to 50%, I think it could go up much higher. And you can just imagine the number of new jobs that will be created, directly and indirectly. And this is a long overdue transaction, and we hope to move forward as soon as possible. We don't have much else to privatize. We have an airline company which is unfortunately owned by the central bank. It's the only airline company in the world that's owned by a central bank, and obviously the only central bank in the world that owns an airline. So it is a very abnormal situation. And unfortunately also, this airline, I mean, is not generating the traffic that it could generate, and we have a beautiful airport that has a capacity utilization of less than 25%. And I will tell you that in the 60s and 70s, we had at 1.4 airlines in Lebanon, Lebanese airlines, private sector airlines. Today, we have a central bank-owned airlines. In 1975, i.e. more than 30 years ago, the Lebanese civilian fleet was 25 planes for a much smaller airport and so on. Today, we have a fleet of only 9 aircraft. And last but not least, our geographic position and the airport was such that around 75% of total passenger traffic at Beirut International Airport was transit traffic. Today, that portion has shrunk to less than 5%. So again, when you see my friend, the governor of the central bank, you can tell him that, and I tell him to his face, obviously, that we need to sell this airline, and preferably today and tomorrow and this month, better than next month. Because, again, this privatization will not lose us any jobs, will create jobs, will increase traffic, and will help to increase growth. What happened in Paris 3? Paris 3 was a resounding success. You know, we have a GDP of around $23 billion, and we received financial support of $7.6 billion. It's phenomenal. It's almost a third of GDP. I mean, I don't know of many countries that have been blessed with this level of international support, and we're very appreciative to all the countries, particularly the U.S., for having come forward with this massive show of support. Now, one should be careful about the $7.6 billion because they're apples, oranges, bananas, tomatoes, you name it. So $1.3 billion is going to the private sector, which is very good. And these amounts are basically long-term loans that will be, the credit decisions will be in the hands of commercial banks. But the funds will come from institutions like IFC, the European Investment Bank, the Islamic Development Bank, etc., etc. Then we have grants. And grants, if you look at the bottom and the second line, we have grants totaling around 1.2 billion dollars. The U.S. is a key contributor here with $770 million in grants. The security grant comes from the U.S. Obviously, all this is subject to congressional approval, so I should not anticipate. I certainly hope that Congress will approve, and I have been having good discussions with the administration and on the Hill to explain and answer questions. And when it comes to the U.S., what has been proposed in the supplemental budget before Congress is a total of $770 million, $770 million in the form of grants, $470 million of which will go for security purposes, and $300 million will go for civilian purposes. 250 out of the 300 will go to reduce the debt and will be linked to the implementation of our reform program, and 50 million will be directly administered by USAID for a variety of projects. And the bulk is in the form of loans. Some of them will come in the form of budget support, but the very large number will come from project finance. And here I have to tell you that we don't need that much. And I facetiously say that, you know, we have all have birthdays, and we have birthdays every year, and we all receive gifts we don't need. And here we have received more than we need in terms of project finance, but that's okay. We may not use all of it. Time is running out. Let's go quickly. We have a number of reforms. You have the presentation, and obviously you can read it at your leisure and ask whatever questions you want to ask. It's important for us to take a number of measures to enhance the role of the private sector, to spur growth, and to particularly improve the business environment. Lebanon has traditionally been a haven for private sector investment. We have fallen behind, and we have to do a lot. And we are receiving the support of institutions like IFC and FIAS in this respect. Capital market development, obviously, but I don't want to dwell too much. I want to speak a little bit about our social reform agenda. In Lebanon, we have significant income disparities, and the lower income population tends to be concentrated in the extreme north, northeast, and in the south. And we have also a concentration of low income people in the greater Beirut and the greater Tripoli area. Tripoli is our second largest city. We spend a lot on social sectors, but the results are not commensurate with the spending. Most of the spending on social sectors is done by the private sector, which dominates the health and the education sectors. But we have some unacceptable social indicators, particularly when you compare them with other middle-income countries. We have a very high mortality rate for pregnant women. We have an unacceptably high infant mortality rate. And obviously these are national averages. I mean, some people in our internal debates have pointed out that these rates for Beirut are comparable to New York. And I said, well, if this is the case, then the rates for the lower income areas are as bad as some of the poorest countries in the world. Maybe it's an exaggeration, but we are keen to address these issues, and we have put together a detailed program and an interministerial committee to implement the necessary reforms. I forgot to mention the education sector, where we also have some high dropout rates and non-completion of the primary school cycle. I have to also say that we have worked diligently with both the UNDP and the World Bank in putting together this social reform agenda. Next, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I would like to open the floor for discussion, but I will ask whoever has questions to come up to the microphone and present themselves or introduce themselves before asking their question. As people think a little bit about the questions that they may want to ask, I will use my prerogative as a moderator to ask the first question. And I wanted to just put this discussion a little bit in the context of the current situation and the political situation, if you will, and the fact that perhaps today one can think of that part of the grievances stem in part from the lack of historically, if you will, long-term social and economic development, if you will, or the absence of the state in certain parts of the country, especially in the periphery. And in the context of the need today to reduce public debt, and this need towards which reforms are geared, how can the government, or how can one resolve the paradox between the immediate need to cut back the public spending, if you will, and the longer-term need to expand public spending in order to address or to tie it in a little bit to the political context?
Okay, you have asked two very big questions, but I think they are very, I thank you for asking them, and they're very important. Let me try to address the first one. I mean, maybe I can reformulate, but if you don't like my reformulation. In many countries, you have political problems that stem from economic and social reasons. So the government neglects a certain area of the country or neglects low-income people, and these disenfranchised or people who feel neglected or disadvantaged, you know, have natural political grievances, and they express them politically. I have a theory, and I'm happy to discuss it as long as you want, that in Lebanon, first of all, economic issues are rarely discussed. I make an exaggeration, but in my view, they should be discussed much more. They're barely discussed. We have almost not discussed the privatization of the telephone sector over the past 2 years. We don't talk about electricity, although most people don't have electricity. I mean, our political leaders don't discuss it, whether it's the leaders of the opposition or the leaders of the majority. These matters, we spend, what I was saying this morning, you look at our programs on TV, political talk shows. Some political talk shows in Lebanon reach a record of 3 hours, listening to some genius talking about, unbelievable. And you have them ad nauseum, these political talk shows, all compete. And you have today, and sorry to be it's a digression, when I grew up in Lebanon, we used to have a lot of comedy shows. All sorts of, like you have in the US, like you have in other countries. The percentage of comedy shows in Lebanon has shrunk to almost to zero. But political talk shows, And political talk shows, we are not discussing the problems of humanity. I mean, we are discussing usually domestic issues, pure political issues, and maybe regional issues. But to go back, sorry for this digression. Unfortunately, the political system in Lebanon is to a large extent influenced by the religious composition of the country, and your political and legal rights depend to a large extent on your confessional affiliation. And today, you could go to certain very low-income countries, low-income areas in Lebanon, and these low-income areas would be, would side with the majority, despite the fact that the government has neglected them, because they happen to belong to a certain religious affiliation. And then you would go to, you know, other well-to-do segments of the population that the government has not neglected, and they happen to be in the opposition for, I mean, in summary, political, not economic, and not social reasons. Okay? Now, I'm happy to go back to this complex issue, but you have also asked the question about the, on the one hand, the need to balance the books, which means that we have to reduce our expenditures, because otherwise, you know, the country will disappear, because this cancer of the debt will eat us up completely, whether we're in the majority or the opposition. And on the other hand, the need to address all sorts of economic and social problems, and particularly the ones that I have outlined, like, you know, high mortality rates and unacceptable educational indicators. My answer to this is the following. First of all, one doesn't need to spend billions of dollars to address these inequalities. I mean, we estimate that we can do a very good job at addressing them by spending an additional $75 million a year. Number two, as I pointed out, and you can look in your presentation in detail, Lebanon is already spending a lot of money on the educational sector and on the health sector, but this money is not efficiently spent. So we should do a much better job at redirecting our social sector spending, not necessarily increasing it. And last but not least, we have to, and we have successfully in the past, relied on the private sector to provide all sorts of goods and services in Lebanon. And we are facing a problem now, and any ideas, suggestions here would be welcome. As I mentioned earlier, we have to increase gasoline prices. This is political dynamite in any country, and in Lebanon for sure. But we have no choice. And in order to alleviate the impact of an increase in gasoline prices on the low-income people, there are two obvious things that can be done. One is provide cash transfers or vouchers to well-defined groups of people who cannot afford the gasoline, the higher gasoline prices. And we have discussed this issue this morning with various people we met in USAID and other parts of the administration to see whether, you know, some technical assistance can be provided in this request. And the second component is to have a much better public transportation system. Public transportation system in Lebanon is very weak. It is worse than it was in the 50s and 60s for many reasons. But here, yes, we have a conflict between the need to have a better public transportation system and the fact that the government cannot afford to make the necessary investments. And therefore, we are looking for creative solutions that involve, to the largest extent possible, investments by the private sector and public transportation.
I do have a follow-up question, but I will let Ted ask his question.
Ted Pfeiffer from USIP. I'd like to ask a question about the political context.
Yes.
The opposition parties have been seeking a blocking position in the cabinet. What is, I suppose, the governing parties or the parties remaining in the government have been focused on the tribunal. Can you give us a sense of what might be a possible solution or deal?
This is a very good question. Unfortunately, I don't have a magical solution. And there are people who are much more knowledgeable than I am in politics. If such a solution existed, we would have been, the crisis would have been resolved. But yes, we are facing a very serious political crisis. And this serious political crisis, I mean, has two obvious symptoms. We have a cabinet that is missing seven members. Six of them have resigned and one has been assassinated. So it's a very unusual and unacceptable situation. And on the other hand, the Speaker of Parliament with the opposition has hijacked Parliament. Parliament hasn't been meeting. And in democracies, when you have a difference of opinion, you vote and you resolve your differences. In Parliament, the majority has a clear majority. So the losers don't want to play by the rules, they hijack Parliament. I mean, you can quote me, this is unacceptable. You cannot hijack Parliament, you cannot prevent Parliament from meeting in any democracy. And if this goes on, we are heading for a very serious disaster. Now, the tribunal, I mean, let's put things in context. We live in a turbulent region. We live in a region where political violence has been endemic. But in no other country in this region or in other regions have you had over the past 24 months a series of political assassinations or attempted political assassinations targeting key political leaders, targeting key leaders of opinion, journalists, writers, and all the people that have been targeted belong to the same group. And we haven't been able yet to bring anybody to justice. We have an international investigation mandated by the UN. We have an international tribunal that, the Security Council has voted unanimously approving this international tribunal. The cabinet has also approved the tribunal. And now it's up to Parliament to ratify. And every time we talk about the tribunal, the opposition cabinet ministers decide to quit. I mean, how can you imagine a situation without justice, without apprehending those who have perpetrated these crimes and bringing them to justice? I mean, and the series of attempts, assassinations, etc., is ongoing. I mean, we recently had two bombings targeting innocent civilians that were riding buses coming to work from the north east of the country, coming to work to Beirut, and these bombs killed three or four of them. I mean, so the cycle is ongoing, and you have people who are basically blocking the tribunal. The tribunal that has been accepted by the whole world, approved by the UN Security Council. I don't see a possibility for compromise on the tribunal. And I don't see any argument that the opposition is making. The opposition is saying, we want to amend certain clauses. These are technicalities. But the issue of the tribunal has been very much debated in public, in the media, at cabinet meetings for more than a year now. And we haven't really seen any significant amendments that the opposition has proposed. So, in summary, I don't have a happy ending to propose or suggest, because I don't think any decent human being can compromise with the tribunal. And I don't think any democracy can function without a parliament. So, you know, you don't have a majority in the parliament. I'm speaking of the opposition parties. They just hijack parliament.
Thank you.
We will fight till the end. I mean, we are risking our lives. I never thought I would be in this position. I lived in this country for almost 24 years. I'm considered a technocrat. I'm very proud to serve my country and my government. But we have no choice. We have to fight. And I would be silly to say this. I mean, these forces are, would almost caricaturize them, caricaturize and saying these are forces of evil. Although I don't like these simplifications.
Thank you, Your Excellency. George Cody, Executive Director of the American Task Force for Lebanon. In the last 72 hours of the July-August conflict, Israel shot or fired into Lebanon anywhere from 1.2 million to 4 million cluster bombs, many of which, there's different figures, but probably close to a million or 900,000 are unexploded. We're in the midst right now of a campaign, the task force, to ban the sale, the use, and the transfer of these insidious weapons. Would you please tell us what the economic impact is, both the short term and the long term, of that decision that was made to launch these cluster weapons? What the economic impact is on Lebanon, both short term and long term, and how do you propose that we may be able to address some of those issues?
Thank you. I'm not an expert on security and on cluster bombs, but I've read a lot about plans to ban the use of cluster bombs worldwide. And I'm sorry not to have a number to quantify the economic losses from cluster bombs, but cluster bombs were essentially Israel essentially targeted rural areas and targeted areas where the main livelihood is agriculture. And most of those who have been killed or maimed by these cluster bombs are innocent, people involved in agriculture. So people go to tend to their olive groves or to their other agricultural crops, and they are killed or maimed. So the impact has been extremely negative in the south, extremely negative on the agricultural sector, and psychologically it has been devastating. I mean, I don't think one can say, you know, the cost is a billion or 100 million or 200, but I don't see what military advantage is achieved by Israel or any party just throwing cluster bombs in this fashion. I mean, I'm sorry for not giving you a more precise answer.
Thank you. I'm Don Shirk with the Center for International Private Enterprise. Minister Haddad, based on your prior experience in Egypt and your involvement with the entire Middle East region, is there a strategy that Lebanon might pursue that would perhaps better involve the regional partners to be supportive of your reconstruction needs? I don't know who attended the Paris meeting, but I would think it's the primary donors of the OECD. But I'm now speaking about the regional support that Lebanon can count on. Would you address that, please?
Sure. The regional donors have been extremely forthcoming. Just to put things in perspective, the war ended in August, and by the end of August, we had a donors conference that was held in Stockholm. We were initially reluctant to go to this conference because we were preparing for the big conference. At the end of the day, we went to Stockholm. Most importantly, both in Stockholm, before Stockholm, and at Paris, the regional donors were particularly generous. And these regional donors are essentially for Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, and Qatar. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait during the war itself transferred $1.5 billion to the Central Bank of Lebanon just to bolster the reserves and to help defend the currency. They later, Saudi Arabia pledged and is in the process of disbursing $500 million in grants, Kuwait $300 million in grants. Other countries have, particularly Qatar, have been providing in-kind support in rebuilding destroyed homes in the southern villages. And from the $7.6 billion that we got in Paris, the first money to flow in is $300 million support from the UAE, which we signed 2 weeks ago. I attended the signing. So the regional support has been quite significant. And obviously, I have to add the money that has come from the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development based in Kuwait, the Islamic Development Bank, and a number of regional organizations. But if you want to summarize the donors, I mean, the donors, I may omit some donors, but I mean, more than 90% of the funding is coming from three sources, from Arab countries, particularly the oil-producing countries, from Europe. Europe, here you have the EU, you have the European Investment Bank, and bilaterals, and the largest bilateral being France, and the US. And the rest is, I mean, very small. Now, there is no doubt that the US has stepped up its aid very significantly. I mean, we have never seen this level of aid from the US, and we are very grateful. Obviously, it still needs congressional approval. And we have been discussing the conditionality associated with this aid. I think conditionality is a good thing. We understand it. We respect it. And it has a number of advantages. It's sometimes helpful for a country or for a policymaker or a political leader to blame others. And others could be the IMF, could be the World Bank, could be the US, could be Europe, could be some Arab countries. And what I have been suggesting to my interlocutors is to try to the extent possible to harmonize this conditionality between the US, the World Bank, the Europeans, and others. And one thing that I forgot to tell you is that in the paper we presented at the Paris conference, we indicated that we want to have a donors coordination committee. This committee will be formed by the end of this month. And this committee will be heavily involved in seeing where the funding is going and ensuring that this funding operation and the use of funds is prosecuted in the most transparent manner possible. And obviously, donor coordination is helpful to us because we are oversubscribed, as I told you, on project finance, and maybe we need more of something else. So it's good to have a dialogue between Lebanon and the donors and among the donors themselves to try to the extent possible, redirect this funding to the most effective through the most effective channels.
Adam?
Minister Haddad, following up on your comment about transparency.
Adam, introduce yourself.
I apologize. Please. Adam Kaplan, USAID, Office of Transition Initiatives. Following up on your comment about the issue of transparency, and given that one effort with pulling Lebanon out of debt is the privatization of these state-run industries, I'm wondering what efforts the government will undertake to ensure that that privatization happens in the most transparent way, and the dividends of that privatization aren't perceived to go to vested political actors and elements that are involved at various levels in the government. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a very good question. First of all, the law in Lebanon mandates that privatization proceeds have to go to repay the debt. So this, the issue is not in doubt here. Your question is very important because the government is very keen to make sure that this transaction, or maybe two transactions, are done in the most transparent way. Let me tell you how we're planning to proceed. First of all, this telecom regulatory authority is vested with vast powers. And this telecom regulatory authority is in charge of supervising, regulating the sector, and supervising this transaction. And this TRA, as we call it, is composed of five people. And the five people were selected through, I mean, there were ads in the papers, we had hundreds of applicants. The names were obliterated, these people were subjected to exams, interviews, whatever, and I mean, almost nobody in Lebanon, in a very heated political climate, has disputed how these people were selected or has questioned their professional credentials. That's number one. Number two, we have already sought the help of two investment banking advisors, Citibank and JP Morgan. I mean, the advice that we have gotten so far, and I'm not directly involved because this is not my portfolio, but you have to always be careful not to trespass on other people's portfolio. But I mean, it's a subject that's very dear to my heart, and I'm trespassing a little bit, and I might trespass a little more. But the advice that we have been given, I mean, first of all, we have to privatize 100%. This is not under discussion. The second thing is, ideally, you want to have as many shareholders as possible, and you want to have the highest percentage of shares on the Lebanese stock market. The investment banks have apparently advised us that we should sell 80% of each company to a strategic investor. And the strategic investor will be obviously the largest shareholder and will be in charge of management. I have a strong feeling that we could sell maybe as little as 50 or 51 or even less to a strategic investor, as long as the strategic investor knows that, you know, they are in charge of management, that nobody can control more than X percent of the remaining shares, etc., etc. Because in this way, I mean, whatever political opposition to the transaction will tend to be less. You'll distribute, because I think this is a very profitable sector, you'll distribute the dividends and the benefits to a much wider number of people. But I mean, this we need to follow up, and any other suggestions would be most welcome. But the strong intention is to handle it in a very transparent way, and we are on the road to reaching this objective. And it's possible that some of the conditionality that we are negotiating today with the U.S. and with other donors could involve aspects relating to the privatization of the telecom sector.
Go ahead. Out of turn here.
Oh, it's okay. Don't worry. It's okay. Okay, girl, everybody will have their turn.
Great. I'm Clay Swisher from the Middle East Institute. Over the past year, I've had the opportunity to visit some of the Palestinian refugee camps in your country. And I'm thinking particularly of Shatila and Ain al-Helwa. The conditions there were the worst I've ever seen of any refugee camp, really an affront to humanity. And I haven't heard in your presentation at all about how your government, your ministry, plans to address this problem, because it seems to me having 400,000 stateless Palestinians in your midst with no rights, no opportunity, no real ability to work or have any economic hope, the country's not going to be really able to progress at all. So what kind of plans, particularly after Stockholm, Paris, what kind of allocation of these funds will be going to improving the lives of the Palestinians, giving them economic opportunity?
Thank you. A very important question, and delicate and sensitive. I'll try to address it as candidly as I can. Number one, you are right in saying that the condition of the people living in these camps is appalling. and I couldn't agree more with you, and I have no reason or intention to dispute that point. Number two, I mean, we are, the Lebanese government is financially strapped, so we're barely able to, you know, cater to the needs of Lebanese nationals, and therefore, yes, candidly, this program doesn't talk about Palestinians in the camps. Number three, politically, this is a very sensitive subject because many political factions in Lebanon talk about the threat or the intention of this government or other governments of giving these refugees living in the camps Lebanese citizenship, and therefore allowing them to become Lebanese citizens, and therefore disrupting the delicate political sectarian balance, blah, 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 blah. So here I want to take this opportunity to say that this government has no intention to make these people citizens, to give them political rights. It's certainly not on the table. However, we would be stupid not to understand that it is in our interest for these people, like anybody else living in Lebanon, to be doing well economically, to be prospering, to be an active force in the Lebanese economy, to improve the standards of living of everybody, obviously Lebanese nationals, but also Palestinians, and we have other people who live in Lebanon and who work in Lebanon. So I am fully in agreement with the idea that everything should be done to improve the lives of these people, to make them full players in the Lebanese economy. But there is a unanimous attitude among Lebanese nationals that they should not be made Lebanese nationals and they should not be given political rights in Lebanon. Now, we can go into a whole discussion about Arab-Israeli politics and whether they should have been in Lebanon in the first place and that they should go back to Palestine and preferably tomorrow or next month. In practice, we know that this is not going to happen. Therefore, yes, we have to be forward-looking, enlightened, etc., and to make their lives as good as we can, and to allow them to play a positive role in the Lebanese economy. I, while not disputing the their economic plight, I mean, some of them are involved in the Lebanese economy, and a number of countries, particularly Western countries, have provided aid and funding at the Stockholm Conference, and it would seem also at the Paris Conference, funding designed to directly to benefit the Palestinian refugee population in Lebanon.
Okay, go ahead.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Do you have any figures on emigration from Lebanon?
Unfortunately, I don't have any figures on emigration, but I mean, it would seem that we are still a very heavy net exporter of human capital. There is a tremendous amount of labor mobility in Lebanon. Lebanon tends to export significant numbers of highly educated and highly skilled Lebanese nationals, and these people are going all over the world. I mean, you may have heard these numbers. I mean, the margin of error is very high, but the estimated number of Lebanese nationals or people of Lebanese descent, and Lebanese descent is taken here in a very wide sense, the estimated number is 15 million people all over the world, for a Lebanese population residing in Lebanon of less than 5 million. And out of these 15 million people, the estimate is that around half of them live in Brazil and Latin America. And these people have emigrated long time ago. Today, the immigration from Lebanon to Latin America is almost nil. But the immigration to the US and Canada, immigration to Europe, to West Africa, to Australia, and certainly to the oil-producing countries of the Middle East is still going on at a heavy pace. However, it's also interesting to note that Lebanon imports hundreds of thousands of relatively unskilled or low-skilled workers. These people tend to work particularly in the following sectors: domestic helpers, agricultural workers, in the heavy industry. We don't have a lot of heavy industries, but we have some, and in the construction sector. And here, the overwhelming percentage of workers in these sectors tend to be non-Lebanese. The largest numbers come from Syria, but we are also we also have workers from Egypt, and we have a number of workers from South and Southeast Asia, particularly the Indian subcontinent, the Philippines, and countries in that neighborhood. Sorry, I didn't give you precise numbers because I don't have them, but just to give you magnitude. Now, one thing about immigration also, which is important, this is a number. Many countries talk about workers' remittances. Now, this, what is the definition of a worker? It could be called workers. Anyway, we estimate that Lebanon receives every year around $5 billion from Lebanese living abroad. This is huge. It's around 30% of GDP. And based on statistics that the World Bank has compiled, this is the largest percentage in the world of remittances or flows that come from nationals living abroad to the mother country. And one thing, this is one of my favorite sectors, I have to mention this. This telecom sector, in which Lebanon was a pioneer, and now we have gone back, and we have lost potential jobs and so on. If you look at the immediate region, particularly Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and the oil-producing countries of the Middle East, this telephone sector is to a very large extent run by Lebanese nationals. There are Lebanese companies, but there are a very large number of senior managerial positions in all sorts of companies filled by Lebanese nationals. Sorry for the long round answer.
My name is Ian Larson. I work here at the Institute of Peace. You've spoken quite a lot today about Lebanon's plans for privatization and liberalization of various state-run sectors, including telecommunications, water, and energy. But you've been speaking about those largely in the context of using the revenues from those sales to address your country's short and medium-term macroeconomic goals. I wonder what assurances you are building into these privatization schemes to ensure that the country continues to work toward its larger economic and social development goals. For example, if you're talking about telecommunications development, it's common to point out the spike in mobile telephony that you'll see in short-term privatization. But it's also true that you see that spike because you can leapfrog technology. You can get that big jump quite quickly when you're talking about mobile telephony. When you're talking about fixed line penetration, when you're talking about internet access, it's a very different situation. And the same is true in energy and water sectors, that because you can't leapfrog, because you are still reliant on the grid, you still have to have goals in place to be able to increase penetration not only for telecommunication, but for water access, for energy access at low cost to low-income households. What systems are you putting into place now to ensure that you continue to move toward those goals?
Can you state these goals again?
The goals of social and economic development, of increasing access to hardline telephones, to internet access, the goals of increasing water supply, the quality of water supply to low-income households, as well as low-cost energy needs for low-income households.
I mean, you have addressed a number of sectors. Let me start with telephones. We have fallen behind so much. We don't have broadband internet. So, I mean, we need to do things that we haven't been doing, you know. So, and this business of penetration, I mean, there is demand, but the grid, the assets of the mobile phone system are owned by the government. The government is bust, doesn't have money to make capital expenditures. Therefore, you cannot increase the number of subscribers. So I'm not worried about, you know, a spike. There's no spike. All the countries have penetration rates of at least 50%. You know, a comparable country like Jordan, with a much lower per capita income, has a per capita penetration rate of 50%. We're at 25. So we can double the number of subscribers. If we double the number of subscribers, we create many jobs. We create many indirect jobs. Most importantly, the competition between companies will reduce prices, improve service. So it's win-win-win. Now, when you talk about electricity or water, it's a different issue, because the issues you have been mentioning of social equity, of access, become maybe more important. And I mean, let's talk about electricity. Most of the regions outside Beirut or greater Beirut are simply not getting enough power, and they're paying very high for power. So anything we do in terms of streamlining the situation involving the outfit that has monopoly power will improve the availability of power, will reduce cost. But we have such a long way to go that, you know, I mean, I don't know whether I'm correctly answering your question or answering it the way, but I mean, we should be here, we're here. So anything is an improvement. We're bound to improve the situation. But in terms of water, wastewater, I have to candidly tell you that I'm not very familiar with the specifics of this sector, but I have no doubt that some of the marginalized areas, particularly in the extreme north and south, don't have the access that we would like them to have to water and sewage.
Judy Barslow, U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you very much for your presentation, which I found very interesting. And I should say that I think of Lebanon as, remembering Lebanon as being a place that had the highest literacy rate, I believe, in the Arab world before the Civil War, and some of the best school systems in the region. I'm not sure that that's still the case. And your own PowerPoint presentation indicates that 22% of students are dropping out of the system altogether. At the same time, we know that the educational system is a main engine for economic development in any country. And not only that, but maybe more particularly important to the Lebanese case, a means by which citizens can be sort of produced with a common national identity, allegiance to democratic norms and so forth. And in this context, I note that, for example, Lebanon has, most public schools have completely suspended the teaching of Lebanon's recent history because it's too controversial. So my question is, the outline presented in your PowerPoint presentation talks about what I would suggest are somewhat marginal approaches to reforming education in Lebanon without addressing some of the kind of basic structural problems that have developed through the Civil War in the post-Civil War period. And I'm, you know, surprised to hear you say that it would only take $75 million a year to basically address the social needs, the social indicators that you've outlined. Do you see a need for more fundamental reform of the educational system, and what is the connection between that and economic development?
Thank you very much. It's a very good question. I'm not an expert on education, but I mean, there are important things that I would like to say here. First of all, the 22% dropout rate is only in the public sector education. And public sector education is what, 25% of total pupils? I mean, the private sector still overwhelmingly educates and treats people for in terms of health. Now, the reason I'm saying that we don't need a lot of additional expenditures is the following. Take the educational sector. We have one of the lowest student-teacher ratios in the public sector in education. We have one teacher for every nine pupils. It's ridiculous. We have some government-owned schools that have no students. And we have some government-owned schools that are overcrowded with students and where the student-teacher ratio is very high. So I'm not underestimating the difficulty of redirecting spending and investment, but, as a percentage of GDP, the country as a whole spends more than its competitors on health and education, but the spending has, in many cases, been misdirected for political and other reasons. You have also talked about something which is very important, which is curriculum or curricula, and whether you're helping to educate a citizen or citizens, etc. I couldn't agree more with you. It is unfortunate that this issue of teaching modern Lebanese history is what it is. One has to be candid. We have not been very successful. I'm being polite now. I'm trying to be diplomatic, which is not my usual instinct. Lebanon became independent in 1943. Okay? And over the past 64 years, we have not been particularly successful at nation building. The reason I say that is that today in Lebanon, you have different laws that apply to different people depending on their confessional affiliation. In matters of inheritance, divorce, marriage, you don't have a Lebanese law. You have a Maronite Christian law, a Sunni Muslim law, a Greek Orthodox law, and a Muslim Shia law. And this means that, obviously, you have different laws. It also means that these religious leaders are not only moral leaders, they have real power. They have judicial power. And this perpetuates a system that doesn't help through nation building. Obviously, beyond marriage and divorce and inheritance, you can say that citizens are not equal because in order to accede to a certain position, you have to belong to a certain sect. Now, there are pros and cons of the system. I am obviously very strongly opposed in principle and in practice to this system. But the system has become more ingrained than it was in the past. And these beautiful Taif Accords, now I'm being totally undiplomatic, and the new constitution that emerged ingrained, reinforced the confessional system more than before. And therefore, we have moved even more from through nation building, creating a Lebanese nation. And this is one of the key reasons why we are facing this political crisis we are facing today. Because, unfortunately, this is a subjective statement I'm making. I don't have public opinions to prove it. But most Lebanese tend to identify first with their religious affiliation before identifying themselves as Lebanese. And, now I'm back in Lebanon, and I'm very happy to be back in Lebanon and to serve in this government. But people look at you first, It doesn't help nation building.
My name is Graham Bannerman. I'm with BNA. I'd like to say we share the experience of having degrees from AUB and the University of Wisconsin.
I don't have a degree from Wisconsin.
I see.
I never got the degree, but I studied for 2 years.
My question is about the debt. When I listened to your presentation on the budget and the debt, It seems to me that there is a great deal of desire to preserve the interest of the debt holders mm-hmm. in Lebanon,
right.
and at the cost of others, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you know, with your interest rates, even if you raise it on interest from 5% to 7%, mm-hmm. that's significantly lower mm-hmm. than most debt holders pay interest in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. It depends what your marginal tax bracket is, mm-hmm. but it's double, three times, four times that. That would seem to me a problem for international donors, mm-hmm. because if you're the United States and you transfer $250 million to the government of Lebanon, mm-hmm. you are then 62% of that is going to pay the debt mm-hmm. of the debt holders, mm-hmm. and they're paying less taxes on that than the American taxpayer is on the interest that they're paying to Lebanon. That seems mm-hmm. to me mm-hmm. at some place along the line, mm-hmm. if you have 185% of GDP in debt, mm-hmm. the debt holders are going to have to bear some of the cost and responsibilities for that.
Very good point. I sympathize with what you're saying, and I will comment, obviously. First of all, it's important to understand the facts. In simple terms, you are right. I don't disagree with what you have said. Almost 85% of the debt is held by Lebanese nationals. Legally, it is held by the banking sector. Now, the banking sector essentially is using the deposits to lend the government. Now, whether the holders of this debt are low income, high income, obviously is an important question to know. Mostly, most of the people would be obviously high income people. But at the end of the day, we are very concerned about macroeconomic stability and the stability of the financial sector. Financial sector in Lebanon is huge compared to any country. I mean, the total assets, the consolidated balance sheet of the banking sector is three times GDP. I mean, it's one of the highest in the world. Maybe Singapore, maybe Hong Kong are higher, but we are in this range. We are keen to, let's put it bluntly, we don't want to provoke a banking crisis, because that will undo everything. And it is easy here, I will use the example of Argentina, and I don't know the details, but most of Argentina's debt was owed to foreigners. And for political or other reasons, the Argentines decided then they're not going to pay, or they're going to pay later. Fine. Obviously, it's debatable. I don't think they made the right choice. But whether they made or did not make the right choice, they were, in their minds, punishing the foreigners. Here, if we do the same, we would be punishing ourselves. I mean, I don't think we should punish anybody, foreigners. And there is a very serious risk today of undermining the confidence in a key sector in Lebanon, which is the banking sector. Now, having said that, we had a donors conference, which we called Paris 2, which took place 4 years ago. And at that conference, Lebanon received pledges for $3.2 billion, all in loans. And we actually got $2.4 billion, because some donors decided, for good reasons from their point of view, not to disburse, because we didn't move forward with our reform program. Anyway, immediately after this conference, the banking sector voluntarily decided to take a haircut to accompany the effort by the donor community, and they decided to give the government a $3 billion interest-free loan. And there were other measures that basically had a negative impact on their profitability and benefited the treasury. Now, we are still discussing with the banking sector what voluntary effort they will make to accompany the efforts of the international and the regional community. I have to be candid and tell you that the banking sector is significantly more reluctant now than they were 4 years ago to make a significant financial effort for a number of reasons. First of all, they're very worried about the political crisis. And secondly, their financial position is not as good as it used to be 4 years ago when they make this sacrifice. But, I still think you have a point, and it's something that is worthy of further debate.
We'll take one last question.
Thank you. Julie Salisbury, I'm with T. Rowe Price, and as one of the debt holders, I'm very thankful for your last answer. But as you mentioned in Paris 2, one of the problems in the aftermath of that was that the reforms did not come to fruition as anticipated. So I have two questions relating to the economic reform plan this time around. The first one is, how vocal has the opposition been, and do they continue to be, with the reform program, given that it was basically conceived under what they consider to be an illegitimate government? And also, what are any of their specific opposition points to the economic plan? And then finally, the last question is, how much of the plan, the reform plan, I guess specifically with regard to EDL and the privatization, the telecoms, how much of that can actually go through during a period of political stalemate? Can these continue to progress, or can we really not expect anything until after the political situation is cleaned up?
Thank you very much. I would like to reiterate here that, unfortunately, economic issues are, I would almost say, seldom discussed by the media. My colleagues may disagree, but I still think that we should, given the fact that we're on the verge of bankruptcy, we should be talking about these things more. Whatever happens politically, the country will go bust economically. Now, in terms of, having said that, the opposition will obviously has become vocal when it comes to increases in taxes. They are not particularly concerned about the increase in the tax on interest income, because this will affect the banking sector and the relatively high-income people. But they are concerned, and they are becoming more vocal about the increase in gasoline prices and in the increase in the value-added tax, which is to be expected. When it comes to the privatization of the telecom sector, there has been some opposition. From the opposition parties, but it has not been particularly vocal recently. Now, it's important to note here that when this cabinet was formed in July of 2005, it included five ministers, cabinet ministers, from Hezbollah and Amal. And we jointly drafted a ministerial declaration. And the ministerial declaration clearly said that it is the objective of this government to fully privatize the telecom sector. There was no objection. It says this is the problem. Now, when we discussed this during a cabinet meeting, particularly the appointment of the TRA people, the President of the Republic objected. And the President of the Republic objected on procedural grounds. And, anyway, but I want to highlight one important fact here. If you look at the electricity sector, the Minister of Electricity, who has resigned now, is Mohammed Fnesh, one of the two cabinet members that, he's a Hezbollah member. He has been more than fully on board with all the reform measures. All what we are recommending here, and we recommended at the Paris conference, is signed, sealed, and approved by the Hezbollah cabinet minister. And more importantly, the main interlocutor in the international community has been the World Bank, And the World Bank and Minister Finch have been having a very, very positive dialogue on all these reform measures. Now, it is not inconceivable that if we were to push forward today, that Hezbollah would be opposed. I'm speculating, but I'm saying that when he was minister, when, you know, he was, I would almost say, at the forefront of reforming the electricity sector. I cannot resist here something that's completely unrelated. One of the, I don't know if I ask you the question here, you know who is the largest beneficiary of World Bank loans in the greater Middle East or in the Middle East region? The largest beneficiary of World Bank loans is Iran. It's not Jordan or Egypt. I'm talking in amounts. And one of these loans was with the municipality of Tehran and with the then mayor of Tehran, who is now Ahmadinejad, who was, still is, I mean, who is now President Ahmadinejad. And when I talked to my ex-colleagues in the World Bank, they said that the dialogue with Ahmadinejad was very pragmatic and positive.
I guess to follow up just really quickly, please, specifically with regard to the privatization, do those reforms have to go through a reconvened parliament in order to happen?
Okay. Many of these reforms, unfortunately, have to go through a reconvened parliament. I'm not underestimating at all the difficulty of moving forward with these reforms in the present political climate. I would like to say here that one of the most difficult things to do, i.e. raising the gasoline prices, fortunately or unfortunately, does not have to go through Parliament.
Well, I want to thank Minister Haddad for his comprehensive presentation, and I want to also thank the Embassy for their coordination with us, which was really great. And I want to take this opportunity before we all take off to remind those of you who are involved in the Lebanon Working Group that there is a session coming up, and it's, mark your calendars, March 16th, and it's going to be on Taifi and the political system in Lebanon. Thank you.
I would like to make a last pitch. I'm not very good at these things. Your help is very, very much appreciated. Yes, we are facing a huge political crisis, but despite everything that I have said, and I'm not going to paint a rosy picture if the picture is not rosy, Lebanon still is a unique example of tolerance, of people of different sects living together. We have had our problems, but we are determined to live together. We are determined to improve the situation, create a better nation, and your help is desperately needed, particularly on the economic and financial side, to prevent a collapse of the economy. And I will say here that conditionality, at least as far as I'm concerned, is more than welcome, because it will help force discipline on a political system. Many politicians will blame the foreigners, but if at the end of the day, by blaming the foreigners, we move ahead with our reform program, so be it.
Thank you very much.
Please, I thank you for this very nice opportunity.